This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And my guest today, or one of two guests actually, is Keith Engel. And you've heard that name before. Every time there's a budget speech, we end up talking to Keith Engel because he explains what happened. Keith, of course, is the chief executive officer of the South African Institute of Taxation, and he has a long, long career in taxation with the National Treasury and as a lecturer and as an explainer of note about what it all means. And this week, and well, actually the last couple of weeks, have been noteworthy in South Africa. You had the State of the Nation address, which set out all the promises and the ideas and, you know, the rainbows and the butterflies. But then you had the budget speech, which was all numbers and which said what is going to happen. And I sort of liken the two to the old political adage that goes, campaigning is like reading poetry and governing is like reading the tax code. I've rewritten this slightly, as in States of the Nation addresses are like poetry, but then budget speeches or budget bills are the tax code. But it's what matters. And it's here, of course, the budget speech seems to have two elements to it. One is the spending part, where the money is going to go. And then the even more important half, I guess, which is where it's all going to come from.
Agreed.
I'm sure, Keith, that you spent a lot of time listening carefully, reading the documents, perusing the charts, and fiddling with the Excel spreadsheets. So what does it mean? Where is this budget going? I have lots of questions, but if you can give us the quick once over what it means, then we can go into some details that I'm scratching my head about.
Just a footnote. When it comes to the president's speech, it has become more important. A long time ago, the president's speech you just simply ignored. There is now something coming there. And you're right. When it comes to the budget speech itself, it's about, okay, yes, here are the grand ideas. Now, where are you going to put your money? Where is your money? Where your money is, where your mouth is, essentially. And so you see which way it's going. Now, on this budget this year, I think we've been through year after year of fear of tax increases. And if you remember last year, we were going to have a VAT increase. And then the SARS said, we will save the day and we will get the money for you. You don't need to raise the VAT. And Kieswetter, in his final year, in his final act, he stayed and he committed to his promise. The bottom line is they got the money. They didn't need to raise the VAT. And so the main thing that was interesting enough, the Treasury said, we are going to abandon any VAT increase. So they got the money elsewhere. So that was good news. If you take a look overall, the essence of the budget is that they're doing a little better than expected because of SARS and because the commodity cycle is favoring them right now. And that little bit of surplus means they say next year, this year is the top of the debt. We're still going up to 78 point something. I think it's 78.3. But next year it'll drop to 77.3. So we're beginning to see, unlike most of the world, that if we just stay the course without increasing taxes, we can drop the debt a bit. So that's the promise. And therefore, you saw normal relief coming through the system. So the big issue is we got inflationary adjustments. We haven't had them for 2 years. So the government decided to push up the brackets again for inflation. They gave full inflation relief. Frankly, they should do that every year, but governments count on that. So they gave us full inflationary relief and they gave us a number of monetary thresholds. And they began to signal here that maybe they're at the end of raising taxes as the way that, you know, as a perennial thing. And maybe there's some hope there.
I'm no tax expert, obviously, which is why I go to people who are. But I can sort of read budgets and I can certainly read charts. Yeah. And one of the things I noticed was that the share of the government spending for interest payments, which is government debt, which is long-term, I guess, five-year bonds and various other instruments, is the single, apparently the single largest single share of the budget, something on the order of, 16, 17%. And that is interest that presumably is at higher rates of interest than might be true if you were to start all over again and issue that debt tomorrow morning. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, I think, let me say this differently. I think you're paying a lot of interest. And so there is a school of monetary, the monetarists, who is saying that you don't worry about debt. It's the interest payments that you have to pay every year.
Mm.
Now, that's been a bit of a trap, because what it allowed countries like the UK and the US and everybody else, they were having enormously low interest rates. And therefore, they said they can assume as much debt as they want. And therefore, because there was no interest, and now all of a sudden the UK is being caught out. Here, I think we are doing a little better because we're getting our fiscal situation a little bit better. That means our interest rates are dropping and that number will come down a little bit. So the more you drive down the debt, and then the more that you drive down credibility of government, you can drive down that interest rate, and that interest rate is more important than the debt itself. But the two go together. And unfortunately, if you're paying a lot on interest, now what you're basically doing is you're borrowing from one to pay to another, or what you're doing is you're burning up your resources on credit card debt, and that you can't have. And so you've got to get some fiscal stability there. Once that starts to run away, you start getting into a very difficult situation of massive tax increases or major tax cuts, expenditure cuts, which is austerity. Or what most countries do is they inflate their way out of it. They just start printing. And in that way, just to close.
That's the easy, tempting way out of this. Just make your currency worthless, and then, so then the debt is worthless too.
That's right. And you'll see that, you know, a lot of countries are done this way. I mean, in the U.S., you know, they haven't done that completely, but they printed a lot. And it seems to me they're going to keep printing. And you look at these countries, and a lot of people are printing away. Well, to be fair, I think one of the heroes of the day in the background is Lisette Kanyango, that we're not printing. And that makes us very different. And that subtle thing, all the mistakes that we make in South Africa, the fact that we're not printing and we're trying to get the debt under control is a better life for all of us. Because once you have inflation, that crushes the middle and the lower middle. So yes, that's a number to be watched. Now, again, this number is at the highest. Next year, it's got to come down. Let's hope the economics are with us, that it does go down.
I understand it too. One of the reasons why the economic circumstances that were running in favor of the government and the country, the commodity prices, most especially gold and platinum, are at absolutely skyrocketing highs, so that the royalties that the government collects and the taxes on the profits of the companies that mine this stuff has gone up significantly enough to make a difference. But, you know, there's always the morning after to those kinds of price run-ups. Somebody discovers there's a different way to make something or other, and the gold hedge or the platinum hedge is suddenly not quite so strong.
Well, that's right. I think one of the questions is, you know, is it sustainable? So you hope that, okay, maybe if the shine goes off of gold and silver, which it temporarily has, that something else will save you. You know, and so to some extent, you don't know how fully sustainable this is. Government at the moment, for one reason or another, is predicting a small growth rate, not great, but it's enough to cover it. Now, this is the question. I mean, government, its prediction, how reliable it is. So you don't know how next year is going to go. At the moment, I think they were reasonably conservative. But again, I would expect gold and silver to basically hold in the long run, because right now there is a growing concern in the world that the US dollar is no longer reliable. And the best way to hedge is with gold and silver. And some people say Bitcoin. Bitcoin is still out on that. And with all the uncertainty in the world, gold will hold a lot more value than it did. Now, the problem that we have in this country is we could be doing a lot better. So, yes, we're benefiting some of the commodity cycles, but we have damaged our formal gold industry. And we have too many of these guys running around informally digging around. And we, you know, and those people aren't paying their fair share of tax, and those people don't give us the same benefit from it. So we are lucky. But one of the things when we do these little things, which you're getting to, is that we're really not doing well for our industries. And we're getting a little lucky here and there. And at the end of the day, You've got to have a little bit more pro-industry. You may not like them, but think of them, if you treat them well, they'll give you some tax. And so we are killing off our industries. So your luck is going to start running out. It takes time. It doesn't go straight down. But at the moment, we seem not to be doing too bad. And the GNU, I think, is restraining the worst of the problem. So really, it's going to come down to politics.
You raised a question about industrial growth, and I want to pursue that. But first, let me take this quick station break. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And my guest today, of course, is Keith Engel of the South Africa Institute of Taxation. And we're talking things budget, because there was, not surprisingly, the other day, a budget speech. Planning Pesach 2026, make it exceptional with Pesach in South Africa, hosted at the Capital Zimbali Resort from the 1st through the 10th of April, 2026. Expect five-star gourmet glot kosher cuisine under SA Bet Din supervision, outstanding entertainment, hazanut and shiurim, plus kids and teen clubs running all day, a luxury spa, and a world-class golf course. Safaris are available before, during, and after Pesach with post-Pesach Shabbat options in Cape Town or at the Capitol. And we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And we are on High FM, and we're talking with Keith Engel of the South African Institute of Taxation. He is the man who understands all those strange numbers that were quoted and that are part of these charts with tiny little wedges that are explaining all kinds of things. Something you said, let me ask two different questions. You raised the question just before the break of pro-industrial growth rather than anti-industrial policy. And that, of course, is the obvious way to raise more revenue, because if businesses grow, they pay their taxes. The employees are hired. Employees pay their taxes. Consumers buy their products and they pay their VAT and so forth and so forth. That's, you know, there we are again with Adam Smith and the virtuous cycle, right? And the second question, and I just want to, I'll put this here, park it for you. You said taxes weren't increased, but as I read this, sin taxes were or are listed to be increased, and the petrol tax and the road accident fund, which isn't a tax, but is, I guess, that's going up as well. And those things affect most consumers, unless you're a vegan, non-alcoholic consumer who walks to work.
That's right. So you'll see that those things have increased, but they say, like on the fuel levies, they haven't increased it as much as inflation. So that's their short answer. But I will say that, especially the fuel levy, you see, one of the things, I just went in a prior seminar, that we are contradictory. So we went and we recognized the fuel levy as a problem. And now here we are, we're increasing it again. And that affects your low income more than us, but it hits us all. You know, that fuel levy one, not, you know, it's easy. The problem is there's ease of revenue and there's the economic impact. And so it's easy to get that money, so you take it. But then you have an economic effect, but, oh, we'll work it out. They're sort of like, well, we'll wish it away. And so some of these, especially the fuel levy, I'm sensitive about. Now, look, I'm a boring guy. I only drink if I'm with somebody nice like you. Otherwise, I don't drink much. I don't smoke. I don't do anything. All of that. I'm really boring. But I don't.
But you'll live a long and healthy life.
Maybe. Yeah, so who knows? We'll get you. You know. So the point is, I hope so. But the point is, when you're looking at all these things, look, your lower income people, this is their vacation, right? You know, and you know, unfortunately, people need these things. And so there comes a point where the problem with those taxes, as you can see, is there comes a point where they get so excessive, they're pushing everybody into the illegal sector. So there comes a point it breaks. And they've been saying this with about the cigarettes and all of that, and government's just not listening. So BAT left. That's it. You're done. Mm-hmm. And you see, government keeps not wanting to hear, oh, we'll solve it another way, but they don't recognize their own restraint. Yes, they want to solve the illegals, but they don't have the capability. And part of this problem in the state is that we're spending a lot of money on theory, But we have to be realistic that we don't have the capability. So we want a state that's maximum capability, but we don't have it and we spend. And so we're really, we have an expenditure problem more than a tax problem. And so what worries me here again is really the tax situation is caught by the expenditure. And I'm not just talking about corruption. I'm talking about misallocation of resources. And because of that, you can see even then, we are now having our tax to GDP ratio is now 25.9. Okay. Now they did a study. I was shocked in the chapter. You look at the list, that is a very high rate, even by European standards. And of course, we don't get the European benefits. So most Europe is one of the highest taxed areas in the world. Now, again, look what it's done for them. They are also in no growth, because they also want to over-engineer their economies, and now they're running into trouble. Well, here we are even worse off, but 25.9, I think, is very, very high on the scale. It's like number three or number four amongst the OECD. Still worse, if you looked in the budget, the minister wants to reach 26.2. So he's still on a trajectory of more and more spending. This year, he got a little bit of relief. Maybe the GNU restrained him. But we have got to get a change at the political level to say, stop. You can't keep increasing the size of government beyond economic growth. And that's the problem. You're always wanting more tax than your economic growth. And it's just not sustainable. You're going to crush the economy. Although what is good about the GNU is we are seeing that taxpayers are beginning to have a meaningful say for the first time. And that's why now, I think we're hopeful.
The problem, quote unquote, with government spending is, of course, the single largest chunk of government spending is, take a breath, salary.
Yeah.
And employee benefits. And that's not unique to South Africa.
No.
Of course, that's a global circumstance. But what might be more relevant here is the output of those government salaries relative to what's necessary or what's presumed that those salaries are paying for. I'm phrasing that badly, but I think
I mean. And that's the difficulty. And so first we talk about corruption. Look, we have to stop corruption, but I'm going to be very honest with you. Even if you had a much better prosecution authority, that money is gone. You're not going to get much back. Your problem is you have too much inefficiency. And part of the inefficiency is you've got people in there that government is becoming an employment agency. Now, if you want to give out welfare, you give out welfare, but you don't do it through employment because that's a very expensive way of doing it. And two, you've got a lot of people that are politicians and that's all they can do. And so same thing in the US, it just comes out in a different form. And so you've got too many people in too many political posts, and that's costing you a lot of money. So, and again, what's the result is every time we have a new initiative, we have a new SOE, we have a new agency, we have to sit down. There are too many departments. There are too many agencies. There are a lot of these things that are not, it's not about growth and it's not about redistribution. They just look like sexy, exciting things. And what's happening is we're wasting a lot of money. And yes, we need to stop the corruption going forward so that we know we're getting what we paid for. And you can see that government is very unwilling to stop the corruption because they're relying on it as a salary increase. And then the second is they want all these things and it doesn't work. So the example I always give people is at the end of World War II, when Hitler was losing the war, he then went to wonder weapons. He said, oh, I'll win it with the V-2 rocket and the Tiger II tank and the jet fighter and all of these things. And when you look at them, those things were not effective. The Americans were able to win the war with having crappy Sherman tanks, 60,000 of them. And what happens is governments get addicted to all these different programs. And part of what the German government was, you're running too many production lines. So, you know, the Tiger was the greatest tank in the world, but there were 2,500, yet the Americans had 60,000 Shermans. So that wins the war. So the problem is this government keeps coming up and tinkering and engineering, and it's you're not going to get anywhere with all that. You got to do broad strokes, keep it simple, and go. And I'm not sure whether the DA or the ANC are going to do better, because even though the DA has a different philosophy, my feeling is they just want to tinker on the different end of the political spectrum. And we really have got to simplify government, not just getting rid of departments in name, but getting rid of regulation. There's a lot of wasteful regulation. And what you'll see, just to give you a weird example, in the United States, we're having the same problem. So New York, okay? In New York, they're over-engineering the landlords. So, and they're over-engineering small business. And what's happening is you're driving up compliance costs and people are leaving. So what do they do? Instead of stopping the regulation, they create incentives. But then when you look at the incentives, you have to apply. It's only the top 30 who get it. Then there's more compliance. And so what they do is they create regulations that are overly harsh. Then they create a whole set of complex regulations of incentives. They need to get out of the way and know they should be there when they're really helpful. And the problem with government, and this is different than capitalism government, it's not that capitalism's so great. If the business is a failure, it dies. The problem in government, failure never dies. The dinosaur lives forever. And as long as you have that heavy government, you're not going to get anywhere. You've got to not necessarily fire everybody, but you've got to redeploy them in the right places. And that's, we're too scattered in our approach.
A joke, I guess it's maybe not really funny, but I mean, it occurs to me that South Africa could benefit from a rational version of the Elon Musk Doge effect. I underlined the word rational and printed in red, bold, all caps, 30-point type. But I mean, Elon Musk's approach was quite clearly non-rational.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think the point was I saw when he went in, I said, you don't know government. You don't know government. And you're looking for quick fixes. If you don't change the regulation, you can't make it more efficient. Because the regulation, if you have too many regulations, little things about getting rid of landlines and all these little things he did, you can't do it. You're just not regulating. The point is, if there are too many regulations that don't mean much, you've got to struggle. You've got to get rid of the regulation to get rid of the waste. And government doesn't seem to want to do that. And but a rational approach, not some cross the board fix that, again, it's ideology of the right versus ideology of the left. Ideology doesn't win.
We're going to take a quick ad break. We'll be back for sort of a wrap up with our guest, Keith Engel. This is The Deep Dive. I am your host, as usual, Brooke Spector. And we're talking, not surprisingly, we're talking budget and tax because we just had a budget speech. And we're trying to bridge the gap between the state of the nation and the budget speech and see how those two theoretically different things coincide.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, not surprisingly, once again, there's a budget speech. And so we talk to Keith Engel, who explains things and helps us interpret what it is we heard. And we don't have a whole lot of time left, but let me offer you the opportunity, if I can. What was the best thing that came out of the budget speech? And what was perhaps the worst thing?
I would say the best thing, there was an indication by government that we're reaching the end of tax increases. And that there was the understanding that the taxpayer is an essential part of growth and that you cannot squeeze him to death. So that is, to me, the best thing. The downside is, and that's why I've pointed the tax GDP ratio, they want to get it, their view is, let's not go after the compliant anymore. So we'll go after the compliant, but he's tapped out. We need to go beyond the compliant to get to the non-compliant. The problem is they're still on a trajectory of ever increasing revenue need. And we just can't be there. We just don't have that state. And as long as they keep looking to more revenue to solve their problem, we're not going to get anywhere. So there's a sense, well, oh, we'll be careful with this group, but we still want more and more money. We've got to end the big state. And we've got to go to the capable state and do what's really important. And that, unless you change that mindset every year, we're going to worry. Was the commodity cycle? Was this up? Well, even though we don't want to get you, we'll put the fuel levy up. We'll do this. We'll suddenly forget and have amnesia and then come after you again. So it's kind of a, that those are the messaging, positive and negative from this budget.
Running out of time, but the one thing I want to talk to you, I want to come back to you again for the next budget speech, really. And I want to talk about, in the president's address, there was that phrase which always worries me, the developmental state. I have a lot of experience in East Asia where there really were developmental states, and the leadership there really pretty much understood what it could and couldn't do and why it could and couldn't do it. And it still seems to be something of it's the mechanical rabbit on the greyhound track in this country, I think, in some ways. And I want to talk to you at length about that, but we'll do that next time if we could.
But that's the issue. There's a developmental state, and they really haven't learned from East Asia what that is. And even then, you have to have a very capable state to be a developmental state. And we have not proven it. To be fair, look at Russia. They haven't proved it either. So it's not just an African problem. It's a worldwide problem. We're not as smart as we think we are.
I mean, in my dream, I want to import a whole bunch of Singaporean government officials and say, here, run the place for a couple of weeks, fix everything, and thanks of a grateful nation. I'm not sure that's going to work either, but never mind. We have been speaking with Keith Engel of the South African Institute of Taxation. It's always a joy to talk to you because you make these absurdly abstract things, make them come alive, and people begin, oh, is that what it was all about? I get it now.
I'm glad. That's what I try to do. You kind of have to go, you know, you go on a run, and then you go, you know something, this is what's really going on.
It's really good to have someone to pull that curtain across to see that guy with the levers and the wheels rather than simply the smoke and the effects. I think that helps a lot. Keith, thanks again. Appreciate it as always.
Appreciate the honor.
This has been The Deep Dive, Part 1. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today was the head of the South African Institute of Taxation, Keith Engel, who understands what the budget is about. He helped write the budget in some ways over the years when he was in Treasury, so he really understands what's going on. We look for enlightenment from his quarter.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Gremlin that seemed to be convinced that we needed to hear ourselves three or four times. And my guest, my second guest today, Sue Nyati, author and commentator, and in this case, one of the organizers of the Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers. And as I understand it, this is something that was initiated by my old friend, Barbara Masekela, who I've known for, oh gosh, decades. And I know that Barbara always had this, when she was teaching at Rutgers University in the United States, she was very, very careful to make sure that her classes in literature always included more than just a generous sample, but a major sample of voices from Africa, from Asia, Latin America, and voices of women. And in this case now, this is the fourth year of this festival, as I understand it, starts next week. And one of the organizers is Sue Nyati, who is a novelist in her own right. And I read something about her the other day, and I was fascinated that she started her career as a writer, writing things by hand, and then passing them around to fellow students when she was in, I guess it would have been high school or middle school. And that set her on a course of being a writer. Now, before we get into the substance of the festival, I want to pose a question to you. Is there a difference between women writers and writers about women? For example, somebody like Flaubert, somebody like Dreiser. Flaubert wrote Madame Bovary, a portrait of a woman in full and with all the difficulties and possibilities that she undertook in 19th century France. And Theodore Dreiser wrote a book, Sister Carrie. Both of these books are about women, but clearly are written by men. And then there are the Bronte sisters who wrote about women. They were obviously women as well. Is there a real difference in this concept, or am I making too much out of this?
No, I think there is a difference. Good morning, everyone. I'm Sunyati, and I'm a writer. I'm a female writer, and I also write about women. But I've also written male characters. And I think the difference really is, as a woman, you inhabit the body of a woman, right? So I think you can tell those stories with more authenticity. And when I write about men, it's more from a place of observation. I can never inhabit the thoughts of a man. I don't know. I can only surmise. I can speak to men, but to tell that story of a man is very challenging. And I think that's what it is. The better you are as a writer, the better you can, in terms of articulating and being able to do that portrait. So I think that's where the skill comes in. But for the most part, it's badly done. I mean, I think a lot of women will say, oh, they got that character, that female character. And I think men also write women from their own perspective, the way they see them, and sometimes there's that sexual objectification that comes in because they're writing from that lens, So I think it's a very complex subject.
Well, that's why I raise it. Of course, we could talk about this topic for hours. We only have about 15 minutes left.
No, we can't.
But let's talk a bit about the Festival of Women Writers. I see that one of the people on the list is somebody who may well be known to many audience members, Patina Gappa, one of
Yes.
your keynote speaker. And I was absolutely fascinated with the it's hard to describe it as a novel. It was a collection of short stories in which the characters all sort of wove their way through each of the different stories and overlap. Rotten Row, which came out, what, 5 or 6 years ago. And I thought, to my naivete, that the men characters or the male characters that she wrote, they seemed rather like people I could believe were men. And
And
maybe that's a
that's,
mark of her skill.
yes, exactly. So that's what exactly that I mean. If you can write convincingly of other genders, then I think you've really mastered it. If people don't doubt the credibility of your characters, I think that really shows that you are a skilled writer. And
Right,
Patina
so
Gappa is very skilled, particularly even in the craft of writing short stories. That is also another skill itself.
yeah, a short story really is different than a novel. You have to nail that character in about the first 8 words, or else nobody believes it. Gone, finished, or done, move on.
Exactly.
This festival, this runs what, the 7th and 8th? And there are other discussions that run along with the opening, or is it just a 2-day event? How is this structured?
So it's actually just a one day. The meat of the festival is done over one day on the Sunday. We start very early. It kicks off at 8:30 until 4 p.m. But what happens on the 7th is the opening, the official opening. And that's normally when we have the keynote speaker and the respondent. And this year, our keynote, as you've pointed out, is Patina Gappa. And the respondent is Nozipho Tshabalala. She's also an author. She had her first book out, but she's all more known for her role in communications and media. So on the first, it's like the opening night, we have that event, and it's a cocktail. So people also get to mingle and speak and just, interact. So that's the opening, official opening. And that's what it's really for, because I think because of the structure of the festival, there's really not much time to chit chat in between because people are moving from the panel discussions. And we also have what we call master classes. I think one of the complaints we had in response to the earlier setup was that people don't have time to engage with the authors. They want to be able to ask more pointed questions, which you can't necessarily ask in a plenary because you're given like 5 minutes for Q&A. So we have now the setup where people can have a sort of like a one-on-one. The author comes in and has a presentation on a topic that we've, selected. And then the audience is able to, have a more intimate discussion and ask more pointed questions.
All right, so the opening is more ceremonial and with keynote speaker. And then the next morning at 8:30, I hope you have lots of coffee out there for people on a Sunday morning, I'm telling you. Where is the opening session is at the Joburg Theater. I know that, but then the Sunday morning thing also at the Joburg Theater in various venues or somewhere else?
Yeah, so yeah, it takes place also in the Joburg Theater. And then the breakaway sessions, the masterclasses, will happen in various venues around the theater. So it's all centralized. And then people, select. You select prior hand. So we have a link on web tickets. It's free. Uh-huh. So people just need to sign up for a class. And then everything's free, even entry's free. And I think it's probably one of the only festivals where entry's free and the sessions are free. And I think that was by design because Barbara Masekela really wanted it. She wants to encourage literacy and an exposure and accessibility of, book talks and book conversations.
And I applaud her for that. I think that's she's done all kinds of things in her career, but I think that's a laudable thing to keep doing, even at her, I don't want to say late age, that's ridiculous, even at her senior age, I think it's crucial that she do that. Now, is it only for women or are people like me allowed in?
No, so our audience is mixed. So we spotlight women writers, right?
Okay.
But yeah, everyone's invited. It's open to everyone. So we
People will feel like that there's going to be some sort of administrative check at the door, like male, female.
Not at all. So I think people just need to be aware that we are spotlight. That is the whole emphasis. I mean, most of the times, women writers are marginalized, right? And so we really want to give them that platform. And I think also we wanted to have a space where, women can engage, freely with other women. But we don't exclude men. There are lots of men who do attend our sessions. And we welcome it.
And we'll be able to ask questions even if we are men.
Yes, definitely. So please come through.
I just need to make these things clear. People sometimes misunderstand. Go ahead.
I believe men can learn something from being there. You'd be surprised what you can learn.
No, I'm really glad that the sessions are free. That really is a very useful thing because people who are aspiring writers, underline that word aspiring, often don't have a whole lot of money.
Yes, true. I mean, writing, as also doesn't pay a whole lot in this country. Mm. So, we need to also have conducive atmospheres for people to access that information. Like, people want to ask questions and they don't necessarily know where to go. But if you come to a festival, you're bound to find someone who will be able to answer your question and direct you in the right path as well.
In case listeners are confused, because the first half of our program talked about the budget speech and South Africa's government budget challenges, and suddenly we're talking about a festival of women writers, we're speaking with Sue Nyati, the author and one of the conveners of the fourth Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers, which takes place at the Joburg Theater, opening night on the 7th, and then lots of sessions on the 8th. Grab your coffee and come in. It's free. You will see me there because I'm fascinated with this topic, and I want to be there, and I want to hear other voices and different voices, and I want to hear new voices. I want to hear people whose writing I don't yet know, and that's something that I look forward to in an event like this. To say, I want to go out and find that author's work and read it now that I've listened to them talk about their work and the way in which they engage. We only have a few minutes left, but tell me, who are the other speakers and session leaders that you have lined up?
So we've got, you know, a variety of authors, different genres. We've got Nevashni Nesudgev. She's a romance writer. There's suddenly been a resurgence in romance writing. So we're also catering to that. I think people also want to read upbeat stuff. We also have Shafinaz Hasim, who's quite a versatile writer in terms of her content. She's got a huge portfolio of work. We've got Lebo Mazbugo. She's an upcoming emerging writer. She's just recently released her second book called Fabrics of Love. It's what we'd call contemporary women's fiction. Mm-hmm. We also have Standiwe Langa, who's a queer writer. And so we also wanted to spotlight queer literature. Then we also have another woman writer, Lisa Ann Julian. She's actually from the diaspora, Trinidad and Tobago, and she will be there to talk about her debut novel. It came out a while back, but another important thing about this festival is we don't just highlight the new authors who are hot off the press. We also highlight some of the older, older releases that probably didn't get much, sort of like spotlight at the time, because it's also important. I believe, good stories don't die. We just need to keep platforming them. And yeah, and I think a lot of books don't get a lot of shelf life in this country.
And one of the problems, of course, I know it's not our topic or your topic for today, is because public libraries are sort of scarce in this country, and the contents are often not extensive. It's hard for a would-be writer or a person interested in literature to browse the library shelves and say, I want to read that book from the 1920s and 30s, and then this book from the 60s, and that author's other work that I heard about and never see in a bookstore, and so forth. It's good that you're doing that you're putting a spotlight on people whose work is not being sold this afternoon, but which came out a generation ago, a decade ago. That's very important.
Yeah, it might not necessarily be a decade ago, but we also bring back those writers. We always honor them at the opening night. And this year we're honoring Buchi Emacheta as one of our the authors. So like you're saying, it's also important because the classics are important, because it's also understanding in line with our theme. Which essentially means wisdom is gleaned from those who've gone ahead of us. And, you need to know what those who went ahead of us wrote. And if you want to evolve and push boundaries, you need to know what was done. You might think you are innovative, but you're actually not. That has already been done. But you need to know what was written before you. And so that's also important.
We have been speaking with Sue Nyati, who's one of the co-conveners of the Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers, which opens on March 7th at the Joburg Theater, and then continues the next day, which is Sunday on the 8th, with all manner of sessions and masterclasses and discussions. And I am pleased to say she told me that, of course, men are invited. It is only the topic is women writers. There is nobody at the door who's going to say, you can't come in, you're a man. And I think it's important that men and women both come to festivals and events like this. So I'm really pleased to have talked to you. I'm sorry we had a little bit of technical difficulty right at the beginning, but we healed that. And I look forward to being there. And I look forward to listening and learning more about writers who I either know or do not yet know. And I look forward to meeting you in person and to talking. And you'll be able to find me because I'll have my white Panama hat on all the time.
I'll look out for you in the crowds. Look forward to seeing you.
It tips people off so they know who I am. Again, thanks very much. This has been The Deep Dive, part two, your host, Brooke Spector. First half of our show, we talked budget speech. And second half of our show, we have, well, second, last, third, really, we have been talking to Sue Nyati, co-convener for the Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers, which opens next week on the 7th of March at the Joburg Theater. And that is pretty much all the time we have left on air. We